Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. From time to time on the show, I like to introduce you to new and exciting health-related podcasts. Today, we're going to meet the creator and host of one that sits at the intersection of the doctor-patient relationship, aptly called Doctor Patient. Dr. Heather Johnston was a pediatrician for a decade before frustration with our healthcare system drove her from the profession. She was an avid medical educator and comes from a healthcare family. Her father was and her brother is a doctor, and her mother is a retired nurse. While in college, Johnston was diagnosed with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, resulting in an enormous amount of time spent in hospital for nearly 3 years. One of the chemotherapy drugs she received caused toxicity to her heart muscle, and decades later she presented short of breath with a diagnosis of congestive heart failure. This was in her 40s. As if all of that weren't enough, Johnston was also diagnosed and successfully treated for breast cancer during the COVID pandemic. Her new podcast is called Doctor Patient, and it's available on all the common podcast platforms. She's aimed the podcast at a general audience with a goal of demystifying medicine and healthcare for regular folks, but also to give healthcare providers insights into what it's like to be a patient. Dr. Heather Johnston, creator and host of the new podcast Doctor Patient, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. We'll start by listening to an excerpt from the first episode of Doctor Patient so you can get a sense of what it's like.
I'm starting off this podcast with my background story so that you, listeners, can understand where I'm coming from going forward. This is an excerpt from a journal that I started keeping back in the early 1990s when I was in the hospital a lot with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a blood cancer. I was really sick and had what's called stage 4 disease. For reference, stage 1 is just a little cancer, and stage 4 is almost as bad as it gets. I had been sick for a couple of months, receiving shoddy care at my university's student health clinics. When I was finally diagnosed back in Chicago, I was immediately hospitalized and basically lived in the hospital for about 3 months, then pretty regularly for weekends over the 2 years that I received chemotherapy. Years ago, the days I spent in the hospital turned into weeks, which turned into months. I became part of it, the hospital. I knew the paint colors, the sound of the coffee maker beeping at the nurse's station, the smell in the service elevator, the sound footsteps made in different hallways throughout the building. I knew the hospital like it was my own bedroom, which it sort of was after so many weeks and months there. I knew all of the nurses, secretaries, technicians, and wheelchair transporters by first name, and knew what was happening in their lives outside of that place. They understood that sharing their outside life with me was a way for me to pretend that I was living out there too. And the windows, they were like a looking glass to some other world that was not mine anymore. Sometimes at night, I'd walk to the end of the hall and sit and watch from outside my 10th floor perch. All of those cars whizzing by my hospital, on their way to someone or someplace, on their way to something actually happening in their life other than this. Those people walking out by the parking lot or on the sidewalk, they look so carefree, so easygoing, which I'm not anymore. I'm both jealous and disconnected. I want that easygoing feel to life, but I know it'll be a long time before I feel it again. For now, I live with this. I'm consumed by only this. And I get tired of it. I'm tired of watching my family all gather outside my door to talk about me, about what to do. They think I can't hear them if the door is closed, but I can make out every other word, so I know that they're arguing about next steps, having teary debates, and fretting about how helpless they feel. There's also arguing, which makes me want to yell at them to stop. But I'm literally too weak to manage more than a whisper. So I lay in my bed whispering at them, "Stop it. Stop it." To no avail. My mother does not know what to do with herself. So she brings a bucket of cleaning supplies to my hospital room every other day. She knows that there's someone kind and hardworking there who's responsible for that task, but she figures that it might make a little difference, maybe increase my chances just a little. I did not understand what she was going through back then. She was just another thing that I had to worry about, because I could see that this was breaking her, but it was also breaking me, which seemed more important, so I focused on that. Or maybe it was easier to focus on that. After I was no longer living in the hospital, I went back home to live with her and my dad, but that did not last long. We were fighting all the time, and I really can't even remember why. It was probably largely regular teenager versus parent stuff, with some stressful cancer worry thrown in to tip the scales against us. Now that I have my own children, I think I would wail and kick and scream and break things and start believing in God and then scream at him every day and night. Then I would show up fresh-faced and optimistic for them. Maybe she was doing that and I didn't know. The truth is, it's still too difficult for us to talk about. It's only been 30 years, you see, and it's still too fresh. And then the doctors come by, and they also think that I can't hear them if the door is closed. I think, didn't any of them want to test that out, so they know that that can happen before talking outside a patient's room? I hear all of my diagnoses being listed, the treatments outlined, the students' questions, which I could have answered, addressed, and the nurses piping in. Sometimes they would just walk on to the next room, and my heart would plummet, because really, that might have been my only chance to pretend to be normal and charming for the day. To pretend that this is all very normal. My lack of hair, my thinness, my ever-presence in that room, my own personal bedding instead of the hospital issue, the persistent bucket in my lap. This is normal, and I'm just a college kid who's hanging out here for the day who will be so charming to you, you group of curious medical students and residents. I still remember the security code to the closet safe in my hospital room. Memorizing that 6-digit code was the only thing that got me through the extraordinarily painful bone marrow aspirations and biopsies that I endured in that bed, since I could see the safe when I laid on my side. 64278. Just a prick. 64278. A little bit more. 64278. We need a bit more bone marrow. 64278. It looks like we might need to do one more. Oh, dear God, 64278, hold still. 246, almost done. 64278, okay. Needle's coming out. 64278, 64278, 64278. It really did seem at times like it would never end. Illness is so consuming, so mind-consuming. There just wasn't space for anything else. To this day, my hip hurts when I see a hotel room safe.
Dr. Heather Johnston, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So we just listened to roughly the first half of episode one of Doctor Patient podcast. And just to recapitulate for our listeners who might just be joining us, you are a doctor, a physician, a pediatrician by training, who unfortunately received a diagnosis of cancer when you were in college. You had stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And as you point out in the episode, I like the way you called it. Stage 1 is sort of a little bit of cancer. And stage 4 is about as bad as it could be. So tell us, I guess, a little bit about what kinds of treatment you had to undergo. You mentioned it was like 3 months of being in hospital followed by 2 years kind of every weekend. What were some of the things that were done to you? I mean, you mentioned bone marrow biopsies. Tell us a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. So there were two different parts to the treatment. There was a first part that they call the induction phase, and that is very intense chemotherapy and testing. And it's so intense that I ended up living in the hospital, as I said, for a few months. Then basically it was a lot of chemotherapy through an IV. I also got chemotherapy in my spine. And then they had to do a lot of tests to make sure everything was working. And that included blood tests and spinal taps and bone marrow aspirations. That's where they stick a needle in the back part of your hip. And they're trying to get the marrow out from the center because that's where the cancer was growing. And after a few months there, I was well enough to leave the hospital, but then I had another year and a half about of chemotherapy every few weeks.
My goodness. And, you know, one of the downstream consequences of that chemotherapy was, you know, decades later, you wound up with or found out you had had damage done to your heart. One of those chemotherapeutic agents, you know, damaged your heart muscle. Tell us a little bit about how that got discovered.
Oh, gosh. So it is a known complication of one of the chemotherapies that I had been taking. So my internists and I regularly, I was getting echocardiograms almost every year. And then we hit about 20 years and there just wasn't really clear data anymore to show that I should still do the echocardiograms. So we stopped doing them. And a couple years later, I developed a terrible cough and then lots of shortness of breath. It went on for months and months and months because I was being a terrible patient and diagnosing myself with asthma when I was, in fact, wrong. And eventually got to the point where I was terribly sick, having lots of trouble breathing. I called my doctor And he said, get to the ER. Sounds like you're having a heart problem. And I thought he was not right. And but he was. And it turned out I was in terrible heart failure.
Oh, my goodness. And so heart failure for our listeners is like where the pumping function of your heart is essentially reduced or not as effective. And so you wind up with fluid backflow where the fluid can kind of back up into your lungs, causing that cough and shortness of breath. And even then get, you know, fluid extravasation into your extremities. So wind up with like lower extremity swelling, which is pretty common, but can be caused for lots of reasons. And so, Heather, you were typically we see this in older patients who've, you know, lived longer lives, but who've done things, risky behaviors, we'd say like smoking or, you know, not eating healthy diets and you know, not watching their cholesterol and things like that, and winding up with coronary artery disease, which is the most common cause of heart failure. There are many, many other causes. But how old were you when this happened to you?
Oh, gosh, that was in 2017. So
you were in your 40s. Okay. So,
but I will tell you that in cardiac rehab, I was the youngest by many decades. I made a lot of octogenarian friends that week.
I'm not surprised to hear that. So cardiac rehab, that's something that gets tossed about a lot. Tell us what's involved with that. What did you have to do for cardiac rehab?
Oh, sure. So basically, I went to one of the local hospitals. They have like a workout room in the hospital. You don't even really know this exists. I had never seen one of these. So I went in and there's treadmills and bikes and all sorts of weightlifting apparatuses. And they hook you up to an EKG and you exercise to whatever your tolerance level is while they're monitoring your heart to make sure that you don't, I don't know, keel over, I guess. And then they track your progress. And so I was there for 6 weeks. And so subsequently every week I could do a little bit more. And I remember by the last week I was actually running on the treadmill for 20 minutes, like a pretty nice clip pace. And I was really very wowing the 80-year-olds around me.
Yeah. I mean, 20 minutes on a treadmill is, you have to have a pretty good level of fitness. I mean, it's not going to win you a marathon, but for someone with a heart problem, like congestive heart failure, that's remarkable. So it's almost like you graduated out essentially. It's like, they were like, Heather, you're good. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
They were like, get out of here. And there was a whole graduation ceremony, by the way, with a cap and gown and music and a certificate.
Wow. That's really nice. And so you have not had to go back to cardiac rehab? I mean, now you're just kind of maintained on medication?
Not one time. So now I take two different heart medications. One of them lowers my heart rate so that my heart doesn't have to pump as many times per minute. And the other one lowers my blood pressure so that my heart doesn't have to pump against a high pressure. And those work great. And then I also don't eat salt. I eat a low salt diet. And I also maintain a food blog, by the way, called Low Salt Foodie.
Low Salt Foodie. I'm going to definitely check that out. but what's interesting about that is, as a doctor, you know, doctors are notoriously some of the worst patients, but you, in fact, sound like a very adherent, or what we used to say, compliant patient, both following, taking your medications as prescribed and then following the additional regimen that's recommended to you by your cardiologist. You have a recent short episode of Doctor Patient that tells how to be a patient. What are some of your tips for how to be a patient?
Sure. I realized that I think a lot of people just don't know how to get the most out of their visits there. And so it struck me that I would just list some of them in a little short take mini episode. So it involves things like writing down a list of your questions. It sounds really basic, but actually most people that I know don't do that. They just assume that they'll remember them, but no one does. When you get there, everybody forgets their questions at the doctor's office. So maintaining your list of questions, making sure that you actually get the answers to all of them before the person walks out. I like to alert the doctor to how many questions I have so they can also think in their head about how their visit's going to go, because they're planning for the time also. Things like bringing your medication bottles in. You might think that the records are right at the doctor's office. They are often wrong. It's best to just bring your bottles in and let people look through them and say, I'm taking one of these and one of these, so that they can have accurate records there. And then I think one of the other tips was just being honest, which can feel challenging at the doctor, especially if they're asking you about things you're supposed to be doing that you're not, or if you're not doing things you are supposed to do. It feels kind of bad sometimes, but it is really important to be completely honest so that they can figure out where they can help you the most.
I think those are great tips, and I would emphasize that bringing your medicine bottles into the doctor's office, because I can attest to that being extremely valuable to try to corroborate or reconcile, is the word we use, to reconcile the medications that you're actually taking with what your medical doctor or provider is also thinks you're taking. It's very important to do that. because otherwise it can be misconstrued. So Heather, you started this podcast. Tell us a little bit about the motivation for the podcast.
Sure. The podcast is called Doctor Patient, and really it is, I only look at things related to the doctor-patient relationship. That's what I think about the most, having been on both sides of the bed myself as a doctor and as a patient through the heart problems we talked about and the cancer that I had in college that we talked about. And then also a couple of years ago, I had breast cancer for a short time. And so I've been back in that patient role a lot. And I have the basic assumption that a lot of the good things that have happened to me with doctors when I was on the patient side happened because my relationships were good. And the few bad experiences that I've had as a patient happened really because my basic relationship with that person wasn't either strong or good or well established. And so the more I thought about it, I feel like people need to talk a little bit more about this and be more aware of each side. I would like doctors to be thinking much more about how their patients' lives are. I would like patients to be thinking about what their doctors' lives are like, because it is a relationship.
So it's a podcast for everybody, for general listeners, right?
It's for everybody, because I'm hoping that patients, who most of us are patients, who hear it, you will hear some, you know, thoughtful tips on how to get through things. And I see physicians listening to it, thinking how it affects their life too. And so I've built, some of the episodes are geared a little more towards being a patient. Some are geared a little more towards being a doctor.
Okay. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. Heather Johnston, who is by training a pediatrician, who is now a podcaster and host of the new podcast called Doctor Patient. And as Heather was explaining, she has been on both sides of the bed. She's been a practicing physician and also has been a patient for a long part of her life, in spite of being a young person, you're not, for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma stage four, it's, what's the word? You said it in the podcast. It's not remission. It's, is it remission? What's the word?
It is remission.
It is remission.
Well,
okay.
Actually, now I'm at cure stage. After 20 years,
oh, 20 years you're cured.
They told me I could use the word cure.
Wow. Okay. So cured from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but then decades after chemotherapeutic treatment, wound up with congestive heart failure, as we discussed. And then you said a separate foray with breast cancer. My gosh. I mean, you are strong. I mean, to have lived through.
Yeah, I'm also a little bit of a lemon, obviously.
I don't see that. Well, so tell us this. In the episode, that first episode that we listened to a portion of at the outset of this episode, episode within an episode, you mentioned that you stopped practicing medicine. And I was wondering, you went into medicine with high ideals because having been a patient, you know, suffering from one of the most extreme forms of illness and going through some of the most extreme forms of treatment, you made, I think, a very conscious decision to try to achieve better outcomes for patients. Just and I don't even mean like the medical outcomes. Of course, I do mean that, but just mean in some ways the social outcomes, like making people feel good or treated well, because as you alluded to, sometimes that didn't go that well in your case. So what were some of the challenges in practicing medicine that, like, in a way drove you out of medicine?
Really the time. I think the time was one of the biggest elements that I was having trouble with. I mean, my dad was an internist, and when I was a kid, I would go with him on rounds in the hospital on the weekends, and his patients would call our house, and they would pay him sometimes in pies and clothing that they handmade for me. And he had very strong relationships with his patients. And I guess I just thought it would be that way when I went into medicine. But what I found in my 10 years of practicing was that, well, it's what my husband likes to call the businessification of medicine, which is that it's become a little more business than I liked. And I found over time that my day was driven by billing and numbers and money, and I didn't care about any of those things. And so I did spend a few years trying to affect change. I was on a lot of committees at the hospital and trying to make things a little bit different. But for me personally, it didn't change enough. And so I did ultimately leave feeling like I could not practice medicine with my patients the way that I wanted to.
I mean, it seems like a big loss, you know, certainly for your patients, but also for like our profession, the medical profession, to lose someone of your of your character. But one interesting thing is your point of departure. I mean, when you left medicine, you didn't go and do sort of non-practicing medicine. You did something completely different. And you haven't really talked about it in the podcast yet, but I thought it would be kind of interesting for our listeners to know. What did you do when you left medical practice?
So I left and I was at home for about 10 days and then got terribly bored. I'm just somebody who likes to do things regularly. And so I took up my old habit of chocolate making. I already had taken a class at a local school here in Chicago called the French Pastry School. And I started making chocolate for fun. And then I started making it for dinner parties. And then I started offering it for parties for friends. And at some point, about maybe 3 months after I had left medicine in my mind, my husband was lugging big boxes of thousands of chocolates that I had made up to a third floor condo for somebody's party that I had been contracted for. And he put them down and he said, "This is no longer a hobby. You need to make a life decision. And I'm with you. Whatever you choose, just choose." And the next day I incorporated and I started a chocolate company here in Chicago called Veruca Chocolates. And it went very, very well, spectacularly well.
I tried some of those chocolates. They are truly amazing.
Thanks. I mean, we got written up everywhere.
And so, I mean, it's kind of an incredible career pivot. And now you are no longer at the helm of Veruca Chocolate, but you are, in some ways, you're not practicing medicine, but with this podcast, it's sort of a full circle moment. I mean, you are back to medicine. Yeah. One of the things, one of the episodes that in the young season so far, you interviewed a physician out west who I actually think was your brother, but your brother works at a federally qualified community health center. And you, the goal there was to sort of take the listener through a day in the life of what pressures a doctor faces. Could you summarize like some of the challenges he faces? And I mean, it may be specific to his practice environment, but what, you know, and he sounds like you, like he's cut from a similar cloth in that he really cares about people. So he has a little bit of frustration with some of the time challenges in healthcare today.
Yeah, I don't think that the things that challenge him are that unique, actually, to him working at a federally qualified health center or being up in Northern California. I think it's actually, I thought his story was very typical compared to the lives of other doctors that I know through friendship. So, yes, it's my brother. He's one of the smartest internists I've ever met. And his day is, you know, somewhere between 13 and 15 hours long. He rarely has time to eat. He does not really have time to call his patients back in person, even though he wants to. And during the day, he never feels like he has enough time with any patient. And I wanted to get that story out early on in the season because when I talk amongst my friends in our social circles, they seem to have this idea that when they're in a visit with the doctor and the doctor seems preoccupied or is rushing or the visit is too short, that it's somehow on the doctor. And I want people to know that it mostly isn't. We are also stuck in the same system that is not good for everybody. You know, doctors are not in charge of how they see patients anymore, nor are patients in charge. And it's really, you know, it's really health insurance companies and administrations, which are all business related. And those entities are really driving the quality of care that you're getting with your doctor or with your patient, if you are a doctor.
Let me unpack that just a little bit. Like you mentioned your father, who's now deceased, but how he had a deeply personal relationship with his patients where he would call them at home and they would sometimes pay him in kind or pay him with pies or things. I would surmise that he must have lamented the state of modern medicine maybe toward the end of his life. Is that accurate to say? I mean, the businessification, as your spouse called it?
He just didn't really see it. I got to be honest. He loved being a patient. He loved going in there and being a doctor patient, I should say, because he loved to go in to a hospital or a clinic and have a conversation with another doctor because he was so far retired.
Wow.
So he actually loved all of that. He looked forward to it.
That's so interesting. So he was really able to not fall into that, the sort of critique of the system, but just to enjoy, I guess you could say, the fruits of his labor. Like he'd worked really hard and then now he was on the other side of it and was happy to kind of be the beneficiary of it.
Yeah. And I think because he was very respectful of doctors that he saw as a patient. And I think they saw that and noted it, and they saw his age and that he was a very accomplished physician. And so they probably also treated him with a lot of respect, which made him feel good.
So, you know, one of your major insights as a doctor who is a patient is that, you know, you've been through such intense treatment that in the episode that we listened to at the beginning here, you talk about essentially anytime you're in a hotel and you see a hotel safe, it reawakens past trauma of these multiple bone marrow biopsies. Oh, yeah. And you kind of narrate this, what it was like, and you remember the combination on the hospital room safe. And so I have to imagine that receiving, you know, a multitude of treatments across many decades, how do you handle that kind of, trauma, as it were?
Mostly denial, I'll be honest. Uh-huh. Mostly I just try really hard not to think about it. It's weird being a cancer survivor, especially if you have very severe cancer, very, you know, advanced. I really don't think that a day passes where it doesn't enter my brain in some conscious or subconscious way. So it's kind of always there under the surface. It shapes everything you are afterwards. It changes how you make decisions and how you live your life and how your relationships. So it's kind of with you all the time. But yes, my hip does hurt if I see a hotel safe just for a second. I can't see a hotel safe without thinking back to that room. I can't.
And it's so evocative too. I mean, you talk about literally like being living in the hospital. And so looking out the window and seeing, you know, people behaving in sort of a carefree manner. I guess at the time it was, you know, somewhere in downtown Chicago or the Medical District of Chicago. Mm-hmm. You know, even the smells or the sounds of, say, the coffee maker at the nurse's station or walking down the hall with your IV pole. Have you had to sort of do those things like recently in terms of, you said breast cancer treatment in the last more recent part of your life?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2020 in the fall. So it was during the pandemic and it was an early stage. I had to have surgery, a minor surgery, and then I had chemotherapy and radiation. The surgery to me was not a big deal. I don't mean to minimize it for other people, but I felt like it was doable. The radiation seemed doable. The chemotherapy was a very hard step to take. As soon as they said it, I really did have a complete meltdown, I think. And they wanted me to get a portacath, which is basically a little IV that sits inside your chest so that they can give you the chemotherapy there instead of in your arm vein where it can kind of damage the veins a bit. And I had had a portacath for years during the lymphoma time. And I said, no, I will not have that. And they said, you have to. And I started sobbing. And I said, I will not have that again. And we actually came to an agreement. We decided that it was not too many chemotherapy treatments and they were going to try in the IV. And so I ultimately didn't have to have it. But two things about that make me think more deeply. And one is that I knew that I could push back. I don't know how many people would know to do that, but I knew that I was looking at just a handful of chemo treatments and it really probably wasn't that big of a deal. And then the other part was just how quickly the emotions flooded back from so long ago.
Wow. Well, I really can't recommend it enough. The name of the podcast is Dr. Patient, and it's hosted by my guest today, Dr. Heather Johnston. Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Dr. Heather Johnston is the creator and host of the new podcast titled Dr. Patient. You can subscribe or listen anywhere you get podcasts or go to the show's website at drpatientpodcast.com. That's drpatientpodcast.com. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening and please stay safe out there.